Hello, everybody, and welcome. I can't do it yet. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is U.S. Paranormal Radio, and my name is Star. We have Aaron and Lisa here with us tonight, and we've got a very interesting show to talk about. We're going to be talking about a couple of two places. One is the Bermuda Triangle, and one is the Bridgewater Triangle up around in Massachusetts on the southeastern end. So how are you guys doing this evening, Lisa and Aaron?
Amazing.
Very good.
Balls.
Amazing balls.
That's the worst thing about radio is we can't see each other because we're not even in the same state. And so, therefore, we're going to cross over each other quite a bit. But that's okay. We'll work through it. So, Aaron, talk to me about the Bermuda Triangle a little bit.
Okay, so the Bermuda Triangle, as a lot of our listeners will know, is a triangle-based margin that's part of the Atlantic that makes up the base of Miami to the Bahamas to Puerto Rico and back to Miami. And it spans about 500,000 square miles, so it's huge. And it's probably one of the most famous of the oceanic mystery sites. So from Bridgewater to the Devil's Triangle, which is the Bermuda, and then there's the Dragon Triangle down in the South Pacific. The Bermuda is probably the most well-known and probably has some of the most well-known stories of missing people and planes and ships and trains and whatever, automobiles. I don't know. Just randomly naming off them.
I
know. Did you never see that movie, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Yes.
There's an estimated over 300 ships that have gone missing in the Bermuda Triangle, over 75 aircrafts that have gone missing in the Triangle, and over 1,000 people who have gone missing in the Bermuda Triangle. And in my research, I found tons and tons and tons of information about these mysterious losses, and from stories from aliens to the paranormal to a curse. And I think it has kind of evolved with time, especially considering when you see a lot of the very earlier documented cases of things and people going missing. Communication was really daunted at the time because obviously you couldn't just pick up a phone and call or send a telegram or what have you. So you actually don't start seeing messages going back and forth, like the last known correspondence with the ship was at this time on this day, because they just go missing and their last known whereabouts were within the general parameters of the Bermuda Triangle. I'll give just a couple examples and how crazy mysterious they are, and each one is correlated to either the paranormal or this ideal of a curse. And there are some people that believe that there's an alien race that live in the ocean below the correlation of the Bermuda Triangle, and that people are going in there and then they're being either abducted by aliens or they get taken by aliens and they're never seen again. And a lot of the correlations that I did find with these missing ships, planes, and people is that a lot of the stories, some of them where the ships were actually found, but no one else was. So one of the most interesting stories I found about this was actually a story written by the captain of the Ellen Austin in 1881. And it was in his journal that he was kind of reframing of what happened on this journey to Boston. And he finds this ship. It's a schooner, and the Ellen Allen is a schooner, and the ship's captain, his name is Captain Baker, And they're on their way to Boston, and just outside of, I would say within 25 miles of the Bahaman Islands, they spot a ship. And mind you, this is in 1881, so we're still talking about steamers and wind ran ships. And they're in a schooner, which is kind of like a steam form of ship. So they see this ship out in the open, and it's a sail ship. So it's not run on steam. It's not run on any kind of mechanics. It's completely sail run. And they see this ship, and Captain Baker holds his men on this ship to wait on the Ellen Austin, to wait 2 days to find out what's going on with the ship, because they could visibly see that no one was on this mysterious ship sitting in the middle of the ocean. And so after 2 days of observing, he deemed it safe, and he picked 9 of his best sailors, and they boarded this mystery ship. And on the mystery ship, the cargo was intact. There was still food in the galley. There were still clothes. There was still armaments in this ship, but there was not a soul, not one person was on board. And all the lifeboats were intact. And so what they did was Captain Baker hooked the ship onto the Ellen Austin, and they sailed on pretty side by side for about a day. And then a heavy storm came, and the storm separated the two ships, and Captain Baker lost track of this mystery ship for about a day and a half. And then once he found the ship again, it was the same story. They found an empty ship with no one on it, everything in place as if it hadn't been moved. And the rumor is, with this story, is that Captain Baker attempted to do it a second time, and he lost another set of crew members, and that he just gave up and went back on to Boston on his way. So, I mean, it's extremely unusual. And these are the kind of stories that you find, these ghost ships that are just sitting there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about, the rogue waves that they were saying, oh, you know, it's probably these huge 61-foot-high waves. But that doesn't make sense if you have this ship that's intact. I was going to ask you your opinion on if you thought it was waves that are just destroying these ships.
So we're talking about rogue waves. So another story in 1872 was the Mary Celeste. And the Mary Celeste is one of the very first documented cases of a missing ship. And this ship wasn't just a missing ship. It was the missing ship and its crew. Okay. And the Mary Celeste was captained by Ben Briggs. And on board was his wife, his two children, and 7 crew. Okay. And a month after they set sail, the Mary Celeste was found by the De Gracia. And when the De Gracia's crew boarded the Mary Celeste, no one was on board. All their clothes were still there. All the food was still in the galley. And the Mary Celeste was carrying a cargo of alcohol, and they were transporting alcohol. And none of the cargo had been touched. All of the alcohol was in place. The only thing that was off was that they were missing a lifeboat, and that there was a single sword, because this is 1871, that there was a single sword left on the deck. Now, some speculated that it was pirates, and they completely threw that out because there had not been any pirate activity in this area. Well, the term rogue wave or walled wave is starting to become a reality. It's no longer just a legend. It's something that people have seen, and they've documented it. And they tried to say that this ship was succumbed by these large rogue waves, that these phantom waves that just occur out of nowhere. But that got thrown out as well, because everything was still in place. Nothing had been moved. There were still plates on shelves. There were still food in the cupboards of the galley. Their clothes were still laid out nicely on their shelves. The bedding hadn't been moved. The captain's cabin, there was no damage. Nothing was overturned. The only thing missing was this lifeboat. But there was no sign that there was a lifeboat anywhere. And they searched the area and still could not find anything. So, I mean, and a lot of people will say, well, it's a rogue wave. With a lot of the cases that I have found, an example of what they feel could happen as that's not paranormal is these rogue waves. And the difference is when these ships are found, crewless, there is nothing to deter that there was damage to the ship, that there was heavy rain or heavy weather or waves that could have toppled the crew overboard, because everything is still in place. Does that make sense?
Are they finding some ships destroyed and some not, or is it just none of them? They're all just
ironically
in perfect condition.
It's either the ship. So what I have found is either the ship has not found at all, like in the case of the USS Cyclops, which is one of the first government naval ships that has succumbed to the mysteries of the Bermuda Triangle. The USS Cyclops was in 1918, it was March of 1918, it was transporting magnesium ore from Brazil to Baltimore, and it had to go straight through the middle of the Bermuda Triangle. And right as it got into the Bermuda Triangle, it disappeared. And it had 304 people on board, and the ship itself, along with the people, disappeared. And the U.S. government, they put out a search. And that's 500,000 square miles, mind you. And they put out a search, and it wasn't even a year. They had to stop the search because there was no evidence that the ship was even there. There was no evidence of the crew. There was no evidence of damage or, you know, attack or weather. It just disappeared. Out of nowhere, the USS Cyclops just disappeared. And you see that with a lot of the ships. They're either there and they're crewless, or they're completely gone. I mean, just off the face of the planet, nowhere to be found, and the crew as well. And with the aircraft, as we start coming into the modern century and aircraft are beginning to fly over the Bermuda Triangle, we start hearing these disappearance stories, like Amelia Earhart, one of the biggest stories of American history when it comes to avionics, the first woman to fly transatlantic, and she disappears in a plane. And they believe that it was this mystery of the Bermuda Triangle, and there was no trace of her, her co-pilot, or the plane itself. Until years and years later, on these small islands, we start seeing debris, and then they start considering, well, maybe that was the plane that Amelia Earhart flew. And I mean, and these disappearances are occurring even today. The most recent disappearance I have found was on May 15th in 2017. There was a company, or there is a company called Skylight, and the founder and CEO with her two children left Puerto Rico at some 11:30 a.m. in a small twin-engine plane on their way back to the continental U.S. And they were in full contact with the tower and with the aeronautics people, saying where their locations were. The moment they reached 24,000 feet, they disappeared from radar completely, just disappeared. And we're talking like about 15, I mean, it takes what, 10, 15 minutes to get from in a plane to get to cruising altitude, and they're at 24,000 feet. So within 15 minutes of their takeoff, they're gone, completely vanished. Well, there was a search for them, and this is a weird thing. So about 15 miles east from the Bahama Islands, from one of these small islands, the U.S. Coast Guard found debris that they believed came from this plane. So there are some instances, and you're seeing it mostly with planes, but there are some instances where there are debris. There is wreckage or something, but there is no trace of the individuals. There is no trace of what could have possibly brought it down. There's speculation with some aeronautics individuals and pilots and conspiracy theorists and paranormal investigators who believe that there's maybe an electromagnetic pulse that occurs that shuts down the mechanics of these aircrafts, and that's what causes them to disappear, that they crash into the ocean, they sink, and their poor inhabitants are strapped in and they can't get out, and or they crash and they die at impact and they sink with the aircraft. So, I mean, and unless we actually witness one of these things, it's all speculation, but it kind of makes sense that these mechanical things that are reaching to a certain altitude, and there is a correlation. You can see a pattern at certain altitudes that they've been never heard from again. Radio contact was diminished or it was broken. A lot of these instances, their last broadcast or their last radio contact is everything's fine, beautiful weather, no problems, everyone's healthy and happy, and then they disappear.
Hmm. Wow.
Marty, you said you had a theory on all that.
Well, and it's been, you know, it's just a theory, but it's been talked about for many years about sea creatures.
Yeah, that's another thing. Especially during the 19th century, they believed that giant squid were attacking ships and taking them, were taking the crew.
Yeah. Well, and that would explain, you know, that there's only a sword left on the deck, you know, and everybody is gone. Well, they got eaten. But, you know, that's just a theory, but it's plausible. I mean, there are things that are still being discovered that we've never seen before. Who's to say that there's not giant squid or were giant squid that were so big they could overtake a ship?
Right, but I
now,
mean,
what
in
about,
that
like,
same instance, Star.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Oh, no, I was going to say, well, what about something
instance,
like, say, a black hole? Would that hold up, you think, hold any water as far as, I mean, because with stuff still being, like, some of it, like, the ships being there, but the people being gone?
Well, I don't know. If we talk about the size of a black hole, that is an infinite gravity that not even light itself can escape it. So if it is a black hole, why are there ships being found with no crew on it whatsoever? As if nothing had occurred, that they just simply vanished. If we're talking a black hole, then shouldn't the ship itself disappear as well? And not just disappear, but be extremely damaged to the effects of the black hole.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's gravity caving in on itself. So you would think that there would be nothing left to these vessels and these aircrafts if that was the case.
I wonder if there's just so many multiple facets and different things going on that, you know, maybe there's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. There's multiple things occurring.
Right. And with to retort on what Star was saying with these sea creatures, the issue is there's no sign of damage. Even if we're talking a giant squid or a giant octopus or the Kraken, their suction cups would cause some form of damage or some kind of depression into these ships. So there's no evidence to that. There's no mention of suction or circular-shaped markings on the sides of these ships or on the decks of these ships. And if an animal were to truly take it, these animals, they use their legs and pull their food into their beak. So if that was the case, then there would have to be some evidence to suction cups or legs being pressed against the hull of these ships. Because that's how those creatures eat. They pull into the beak of their mouth, which is way up into their head. So, I mean, that's why I just don't see how that would be plausible, in my opinion.
Right. Well, and the only thing that I think about with that is the old paintings and drawings, because, you know, that was how they described what they saw, and some of them are with tentacles. Some are like huge, ginormous eels, you know, that wrap themselves around the boat. Now, I see what you're saying, though, because that much pressure, you're going to have some damage to the ship.
Right, some form of depression, even if it's not significant, but it's noticeable.
Uh-huh.
No,
I mean,
have you all heard of the methane gas?
You kick a car door hard enough. I don't know. I've heard that certain gases, such as methane, is rising up from the ocean floor. But this is why I don't feel that that is
not. Because they can cause it to sink in no time.
Right. And honestly, I've read through these theories of what people believe that it could be and what it couldn't be. But putting the scientific method to it, it just doesn't ring any bells to me, because like the sea creature, there is no depression on the hull of these ships. There is no sign of damage. It's just that these people have disappeared, and that's even if the ship is found. The same could be said, in my opinion, to the methane. The ocean is filled with oxygen. We get more oxygen from the ocean than we do from trees. A lot of the Earth's oxygen comes from the ocean. So if we're talking, and now mind you, in this same area, in the Atlantic Ocean, we have the deepest portion of the ocean on Earth, in the, I'm not going to remember it. It's the trench, the
Marianas Trench.
Thank you, the Marianas Trench. So we have all of this oxygen being pulled up. Now, we're talking like hundreds of feet underwater to the surface of the water of the seabed, and if methane is seeping up through the ocean floor, then it has to go through all of that water, and it's being diluted and broken down before it even reaches the crest of the water itself. So even if it did, even if methane was able to break the surface of that water, how potent is it going to be, and how much methane is truly getting through?
Mm-hmm. Well, if we're
do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, there is it can even reach the planes and cause them to crash. Besides the sink shipping, but
right.
Like you said, I mean that is a lot of water to get through.
I mean, the closest thing I would find that I could wrap my own brain around is this magnetic field theory, that there's a higher sensitivity of a magnetic field inside this area, and it has caused, and it can cause things like, I mean, magnetic fields affect magnetic and mechanical instrumentation. So if you're on a ship in 1871 and you're using a compass that runs on a magnet, because most compasses do, I could see how if it was a magnetic field issue that it would affect that compass, and you could get lost easily, and you know, if you're going in circles, you craziness, sea fever, and all that. Same with aircraft. You're flying an aircraft, you fly through this very sensitive magnetic field, and it shuts down your mechanicals, all your little computer devices and the mechanics of your aircraft, and you crash. I mean, I could see and wrap my head around that theory. And it would be very, very interesting if they did more and more research into that kind of theory, that magnetic theory, because we know that at different variations of altitude, the magnetic the polar magnetic measurements are different. When you get closer to electronics, their magnetic pulse is a little higher than if you're away from them. So I'm wondering if there's like sensitivity or thin spots or thick spots in different places.
The one they're calling the Hutchinson effect or electronic fog, that sounds just like what you're referring to. And then there's a Vancouver scientist, John Hutchinson, that it's named after, who's been doing experiments on it. But it, same thing like you're describing about stuff, the equipment just not working, electronic equipment and other instruments just malfunctioning. So it sounds like there has been some kind of research, but I don't know to what extent and how old that research is. But his name is John
Hutchinson. Right, and
Hutchinson.
If they're continuing the research today.
Yeah, exactly.
But my question is, still, where are the bodies on these ships?
Well, if we think pragmatically, if we think logically, and we're talking about the bodies, let's say that these individuals did not just poof and disappear. Let's say that something happened, for argument's sake, and they had to jump overboard, right? You would only need about 15 minutes, and that's being very generous. That's being extremely generous. But you would only need about 15 minutes in that water to die of hyperthermia. And that's, like I said, that is being extremely generous because the water is so cold. And, I mean, the body isn't just – sometimes the body will think, but let me give you a great example. When Titanic sank, there was about 2,100 people aboard the ship, and only about maybe a third of that survived on the lifeboats. The rest of those bodies that were in the water, and a lot of people don't know this, but they actually sent retrieval parties to collect the bodies from the sinking of the Titanic. And they didn't, they only found about 100 people. They only found about 100 bodies. Other bodies had floated away. Other bodies had sank. Bodies that were floating on top of the water were eaten by other animals. So, I mean, those are possibilities that could have happened in these instances as well. If they did, for argument's sake, jump overboard for whatever reason, and they die of hyperthermia in the water, the current, for one, is going to take them, and it's going to take them very quickly because they're very small in this large bathtub, and the current itself is moving very quickly compared to their small stature, and they could end up in other bodies of water. They could be eaten by other animals such as sharks or orcas or fish or what have you. There are crabs that feast on flesh. There are various types of fish and jellyfish that eat flesh. So, I mean, those are all possibilities. If there truly was jumping overboard and the bodies were in the water and they died, then, you know, they could have either been eaten by other creatures, floated away to other areas where they got eaten by other creatures, and or they sank to the bottom. So,
okay. Well,
I mean,
those
are the... That's the realism of if they jumped overboard. But there's no evidence.
Well, I get that. But if it was something so, just like the one ship you were talking about, and the sword is still on deck. If it was a rogue wave, then that would, to me, would have destroyed the ship or at least capsized it.
Well, and if it didn't do either of those, you would still see disruption in cargo. You would still see disruption in cabins where tables were moved or personal items were displaced. But there was none of that on these ships. It was as if they just disappeared and the ship was left behind.
Right.
Food was still in cupboards.
So
tables
in their,
were still upset.
And here's a theory right here. Who in their right mind would jump overboard and leave a perfectly good ship?
And
what would have propelled them to do so?
Well, and that's even if they jumped overboard. I mean, that's where that paranormal comes in, is that the unknown, what happened. And that's why a lot of theories that have come out over, I mean, just the last century and the 20th century, that aliens are involved, that there's some kind of alien connection there where these people are abducted or there's an alien race living in the ocean underneath the Bermuda Triangle and they're taking people to either live with them or test on them or whatever. But I think the Bermuda Triangle is like probably one of the best examples of how human beings, when they don't know or understand something, have to create an answer for it. And we have to give it reason. We have to give it some kind of explanation to its cause. And I think the Bermuda Triangle will always just be one of those mysterious places that we don't ever find an answer to.
Yeah, right. Well, and it's always intrigued me, you know, I've watched movies on it or whatever, you know, documentaries on it. I know they have found those rocks that appear to be a wall underwater in part of the Bermuda Triangle. I want to say it's on the edge of it, close to Florida or the Caribbean anyway. But, you know, I've always been intrigued by that that type of stuff, I guess, because I like paranormal things.
Yeah.
But
and you know, and that's the other thing, right? It's just when you think they're starting to be conspiracies, maybe it's just coincidental. New things pop up, right?
Right.
Like, I can't remember the year. I think it was around 2012, 2013. But there was speculation that they found a crystal pyramid in the Bermuda Triangle. And then all of a sudden it came out that it was false and that it was fabricated, because that's how engulfed we are in the I want to say conspiracy culture, or in the assumption culture of what the Bermuda Triangle is. And I think we are in so much thrall of wanting to know what it is about and why things are happening there, that we totally just grab onto the first explanation or the first understanding that someone claims they found or they did, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do. Well, let's go on to the next one, which is the Bridgewater Triangle of Massachusetts. And I've been doing a lot of study on this all afternoon, and I found quite a few things. I had never heard of this place before. Lisa, how in the world did you find this place?
Well, just being friends with John, he had done when I hosted the Paracon in Texas, he had did a big thing on it, and I saw a video where he was part of an episode on TV where they talked about it and just described it, and, you know, it fit in with the whole paranormal as far as crypto and just all the different theories and things that they report happening there. So it's like, well, that's, you know, it's another fascinating triangle that's definitely worth exploring more.
Mm-hmm. And now, is that John Brightman that you were talking about?
Yeah, John Brightman.
Oh, okay. Cool. Well, let me just tell you a little bit about what I have found out about it. Now, this is a place, like I said, in Massachusetts. It is in the southeastern region. And everybody, I want to apologize for my voice. I've been very sick this week with a cold. And hopefully I'm on the upswing now. But anyway, the Bridgewater Triangle of Massachusetts. Now, there is a lot of stuff. And, you know, we were talking earlier about any similarities between the Bermuda Triangle and Bridgewater Triangle, Aaron. And there is a similarity that I found in the fact that people go missing. And there's only been a few that have been found in the Bridgewater Triangle. And one such was a young kid, a little boy, and he disappeared. There were people out looking for him, and he just wandered out of the forest, and they were asking him, you know, where have you been? And he said, well, I can't remember. All I remember is I needed to pick the pretty flowers. And so he, you know, that's all he can remember. There is no memory of where he was. That could be shock, but there was no memory of where he was, what he was doing except picking flowers. And he came out with a bunch of sticks and bundled up in his arms with flowers. So that was the only similarity that I could find, Aaron.
Yeah, there's still a lot of UFO reports in that area, though. And that would kind of tie in as well.
Yeah, the UFO reports. Let's see here. Where are those in my notes? I know I saw those.
I saw them going
somewhere.
All the way back to 1760 was the first one,
yes.
It looks like.
It says here that the strange lights in the sky, there has been pictures or photographs. There have been reports going back over 100 years, so there's that for you, Lisa. There was a mass sighting of lights in the sky or UFOs in 1972. So, yeah, there's a lot, and I didn't even get all of them. I just picked those out because I thought, well, you know, we have a very little time tonight to talk about all of this stuff. But let's talk about the Native American influence there. In the, it's called the Hockomock Swamp. And what this, what significance there is number one, it was considered holy ground in that area. There was a massacre there of the Native Americans. There was a final holdout by Metacomb and his Native warriors in those days leading up to the complete annihilation by the English and King Charles II. Now, what happened was is they got into that they went in there and they hid under this huge cliff, this rock. It kind of had a cave going back underneath it, and they hid in there. Metacomb, who was also known as Philip, he got shot, and they drug him into this cave where he finally died in this cave. But he, in his death, cursed that particular land in there. He cursed all of that land in the Bridgewater Triangle. And which was their land. It was holy land, according to them. They would do their rain dances and their ceremonial dances there. And there were nearly, during this massacre, there was nearly 3,000 men and women and children that were killed. Who were not killed, they were sold onto slave ships, and they took them to the West Indies, which is, you know, the island, one part of it was an island chain in the Caribbean. And to this day, the landscape is dotted with stone monuments to their lives. Now, the profile rock that is of great interest to this tribe, and I believe they're called the Wampanoag tribe. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly.
I think it's the Wampanoag, isn't it?
No, Wampanoag. There we go. Okay. I'll trust you because you are the history major in this little group.
Exactly. Yeah, I think there's the Wampanoag.
Wampanoag.
We go to you for all the pronunciation.
Well,
yeah, I think it's the
Wampanoag.
Their chief was Anawan, right?
Yes.
This great figure that they had? Okay.
Yes. There's a profile rock located right on the edge of Freetown, Massachusetts. And it's a natural granite formation. And it resembles a human face. I saw the picture, and it really does. It resembles a Native American face, you know, the cheeks and the nose, everything. But it watches over the woods there, and the locals there claim that the natives believe the face to be an image of Chief Massasoit. Did I say that one right? Which is the father of Metacomb, the chief. But he was friendly to the newly arrived English as they were coming over. He treated them well. But then there was a clash when Philip came along, Metacomb, I believe Metacomb, I'm not sure how to pronounce that, But there was a crash with them. They probably tried to take, you know, over that land there. But that's my opinion. But today, the pictures that I saw, there's really crude graffiti on that monument or that rock that has the face in it. And that's all naturally made, that granite. Nobody made that. It was just natural, the way that it looks, and it does look like a face.
And next thing we're going to hit on cursive.
Yes, he did. He cursed that land as he was laying in the mud. And then when they took him back to the cave, he cursed it again, and that's where he died. But now, as far as some of the stories go that come out of the Bridgewater Triangle, I have a couple that just really stood out to me. Number one was Thomas Downing. Now, he was a police sergeant in 1971. He reported a 6-foot-tall winged creature. And when the creature stuck its wings out, the wingspan was double that of the height of this thing. And he said he saw it on late at night on a country road. Now, some people theorize that this was the Native American Thunderbird that we see on totems a lot. Did you guys, Aaron, I know that you're Native, part Native. Did you guys have a Thunderbird as part of your tribe?
As part of the Cree?
Yes, part of the Cree.
I want to say yes, but I don't really think there is, I mean, not probably not in the same aspect that maybe these tribal Indians had. But because, and the Cree, especially if it's like there's the Plain Cree, there the Plains, I want to say that correctly so no one thinks I'm saying plain. Because there's no such thing as Plain Cree. We're pretty awesome. But
yes,
there's the Plains Cree, and then there are like Mountain Cree. But we don't see a lot of that's like a East Coast kind of mythology.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what I'm saying? Do you understand? So the Thunderbird mythology is a lot of the East Coast natives. A lot of your West Coast, Middle America, that Mexico border, they inspired a lot of their beliefs, and it's very interesting. We'll have to do a show on this one day about Native American mythology and ideology on how their creation stories came about, because they're so similar in the way they discuss the, like, we have the compass, but they and we have the northeast, southwest, but they also have up and down, and how their pagodas and their different huts and teepees and all that, how they corresponded to that. But you see not as many like mythological creatures in the westernized Indian cultures as you do in the easternized Indian cultures. I can definitely do some research. If we decide to do a show on the Native American spirituality and legends, I would definitely love to do some research on whether or not my own people have a Thunderbird theory, but I'm not really recalling one at the moment. So I'm going to say yes and no. So we can cover the base.
I think that would be a great
topic. I don't want to speak out of turn. Yeah, because I don't want to speak out of turn. But, I'm not really sure, but that's definitely something I can look into. But I have heard of the Thunderbird legends of a lot of the East Coast Native Americans. And it would definitely make sense. You watch these large storms roll in from the ocean, and it's moving fast, and sometimes those clouds look like flapping birds. So I don't know. It would definitely be an interesting show to do in the future, is Native American folklore and mythology.
Oh, yeah, I think so, too. I think that would be fun, because just studying this, you know, and well, of course, next week Sheila Gay is going to be on with us, and we're going to be talking about curses. And, you know, just the power of a curse, and, you know,
intent.
Chief Philip did, the curse that he put upon that land, you know, is that what was going on? Is that why that area is so befuddled with so many things going on?
Sorry, goes back to the same question that you asked, Aaron. Where are the bodies?
Exactly.
Right.
Well, but some have been found, but then there's some that, even though search parties have been out looking for them, they haven't found them.
So, but and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Star. But there are other sightings in this area as well, right? Not just the alien UFO sightings, the missing people, or the Thunderbirds.
Absolutely.
There's like Bigfoot sightings and, I mean, other
cryptids,
paranormal creatures sightings, right?
Well, here's a list of the occurrences. Strange lights in the sky or UFOs, hairy creatures in the swamp, Bigfoot. Just one of the stories, there were two officers in 1972, I believe, or the early 70s. They were sitting in their car, and all of a sudden, their car begins to be lifted off the ground. And they're freaking out, you know, what in the world's got us? Well, one of the guys looks in his mirror, and he sees this, he called it a bear man, like half bear, half man. And it was huge and strong. But these are two police officers.
Well, it had to be strong to lift a car, because I don't think Ethel can lift a car.
Now, you said
exactly.
1972. Was there a specific date on that occurrence?
You know, I'll have to go back and look, but I believe it was either 1972 or 1970, because Thomas Downey, the police sergeant, was 1971 when he saw the winged creature. There has also been pterodactyl-like reports of pterodactyl-like creatures, that's what I'm trying to say, seen in that area by other people. Now, here's another
flying,
one.
Flying animals with four toes.
And giant
wings.
So
that's tetradactyls. Terra is three, so it's three toes.
Okay, well, either way. It was a big old bird.
Snake, large snake.
I'm like, Terra, tetra.
Yes, I got you. I love you, Aaron. Now, there's been
My Latin is terrible. My Latin is terrible.
So
pterodactyl is three-toed or three-fingered. Tetradactyl is four-fingered.
I'm not a Latin.
Very interesting if you think about it, and it's even more interesting that it's in our own backyard. And you know, we get a lot of, especially with what we do with U.S. Paranormal, we hear a lot of stories about hauntings and demons and shadow people and this and that. And it's very interesting to hear about these other realms of paranormal activity that's going on in our own backyard. And we ourselves don't do a lot of research into like the Bigfoot and the Thunderbirds and the Mothman mysteries and things like that. I mean, we talk about a lot of that stuff here on our show. But ourselves, when we do our investigations, we permissibly stay within that spiritual paranormal realm. So it's very interesting to see that in our own backyard that there are these oddities that are going on, very much like the Bermuda Triangle or like the Dragon's Triangle in the South Pacific. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it is. It really is, you know, because, you know, I primarily, speaking for myself, primarily deal with spirits, entities, that type of thing. But I've always been fascinated with cryptozoology and some of the things and learning about them. I've gone out and, you know, hunted for Bigfoot a couple of times, but you know, ghosts, demons, that kind of thing, angels. That's more of my.
That's
niche,
your
you
kitchen.
Call it.
That's what you feel good.
That's
in.
My kitchen, and I like to cook in it.
haven't heard of that one.
Well, speaking of ghosts, there is a spirit in disheveled clothes standing on the side of the road looking for a ride. That's one of them.
You know,
that is very
interesting because a lot of places have that lone hitchhiker story when it comes to, you know, the lone hitchhiker. You pick them up and they get in the back of your vehicle and you can see them in the rearview mirror, and then 1 minute they're there, the next minute they're gone. The person who picks them up ends up in an accident, or, you know, I mean, there's so many variations to that lone hitchhiker story, but it's so interesting that one is tied to that area as well.
Right. Well, and Native American ghosts doing their dances and just walking through the woods. Also, there is a ghost trucker. Now, this reminded me of a movie that I saw back in the 70s, and I don't know if it's based off of it or not, but this ghost trucker, people will be driving along, and ahead of them, coming towards them, will be this big semi. And the semi will go over into their lane, and it's blowing its horn, you know, really loud, and all of a sudden it just passes right through them if it doesn't cause them to have an accident. It just passes right through them, and they say that the people say that they can see the ghost trucker sitting in the truck driving. That's weird. I mean, talk about having a heart attack.
Could you imagine driving down the highway at night and all of a sudden there's a dead trucker sitting in your front seat? And
exactly.
But he's driving
his
own vehicle.
The thing is this guy, this ghost, he's been seen in the daytime and at nighttime doing this very same thing. And it's on I can't remember the name of the road, Copycut or Copacut Road, something like that, but it's near Fall River, Massachusetts.
Fall River, I know. How do I know Fall? There's a lot of, is it Fall River? There's a forest there.
There's a movie about Fall River, I believe.
There's a forest there, correct?
Yeah, part of Bridgewater is part of
forest has a lot of mutilation attached to it, like satanic rituals, animal sacrifice, suicides. Wasn't there even a gang war at there one point?
I'm not sure.
A serial killer?
That forest has a lot of death attached to it.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's even been a serial killer that is still on the loose, but there's been, in 2015, there were two bodies of women found, and that was near the border of Brockton, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And we don't have much time, but I'm going to try to get through this. But they were severed body parts, a foot, calf, and the part of an arm. And they were placed on top of one another in a ritualistic fashion. And it's been questioned if these were part of the satanic rituals that have been associated with the mutilated cats and cows and the other animals around there. But that was close to Freetown, where these mutilated cats and cows and whatever else were found. But, you know, who's to say, you know, people travel. But there's been disappearances of children, like I told you earlier, and only few of them were found. The rest of them are completely gone. I mean, they can't find not even bones. The crazy trucker, I already talked about him. There's a lake, Nippinicket, that were cryptids have been seen.
We just want to apologize. We want to apologize to anybody in that area who knows these places, and we are just butchering their names.
Yeah, because
so,
they would do the same to Texas.
All right, so if you know a phonetic way to write out these names, please share them to our Facebook page, and we will come back and we will pronounce them correctly. So,
yes.
Just
well,
let me say, we apologize for the butchering, for the satanic ritual of the names of your areas.
Yes. Anyway, in this particular lake, there's been UFOs that have been seen, mysterious lights, and enormous snakes. One snake so big that it has been blamed for messing up the local trout population in that lake. There are frogs raining out of the sky into this lake. I mean, have you ever heard of anything like that except in Exodus?
Well, one time, but it, you know, it came with a whole other set of plagues.
But
it rained cats and dogs, it rained frogs.
Now,
right.
Now this is anywhere in the Bridgewater Triangle, but orbs that float through and weave around the trees. That's also been kind of thought to be maybe the Native American spirits. But anyway, that's what I found. Also, there were two people born there that traveled with the circus. They were in the sideshow. One was the human skeleton, Isaac W. Sprague. He was born in the mid-1800s, but he was also known as the original Thin Man, and he was less than 45 pounds when he died. And then there was General Tom Thumb, who was born in the Bridgewater Triangle, and he only stood 25 inches tall.
So literally 1 inch over 2 feet.
Yes. A little bitty fella. Tom Thumb.
Little tiny man.
Yes. Tiny man.
You know, I was just reading, too, that they're creating a series, and this was dated this year in August, based on the Bridgewater Triangle FX. They're calling it America's Bermuda Triangle.
Okay.
But the details are kind of thin. It's a Noah Hawley, H-A-W-L-E-Y, or that's how to pronounce it. It says he's the force behind the series Fargo, and then his company is 26 Keys Production, and they're reportedly going to be exclusively producing this kind of horror thriller. So they're turning it into
fantastic. So
like a
if this
a
is
scary movie.
Interests any of our so if this is an interest that anybody that's listening is interested in this subject and wants to learn more, watch the show. That's probably. I mean, it's FX, so it probably is going to have a little fictional gear to it.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, it's probably a good way to get a good idea of the kind of things that go on.
It'd be interesting to see how much they put in that's, like, how much is what we're finding versus how much is, you know, made up and tossed in there.
Right. Also, this topic of Bridgewater has been studied and written about in a lot of the local papers, including the Boston Globe and Boston.com. You find all kinds of articles in there. And also Ranker.com has an article on it. And it's really interesting. I read most of this where I got a lot of my material tonight. But there's also a guy by the name of Lauren Coleman. He was a famed cryptozoologist and folklorist, and he wrote about it in the book Mysterious America.
Fantastic. Thank you for that information. So if you like today's show and you want to join us again on our next show, we invite you to tune in, listen in, tell your friends. We want to thank you for your time. Lisa, Star, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me. I feel like a guest
on
tonight.
Yeah, right.
Last minute.
And remember, our next show is going to be about curses. And Lisa, will you tell us our guest one more time?
We will have guest Sheila Gay on the second half to talk. She is a witch.
Sheila Gay.
So she'll talk about curses in relation to that, and then we can hit any other kind of curses along the way prior to that. So
fantastic.
Curses.
All right, guys, have a great night. Curses. Okay, this is U.S. Paranormal, and we're signing off.
Bye. Good night, guys.
It's over. Bye-bye, y'all.